Distributing the Future, Beta Broadcast number 5.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and this is part 2 of a series that highlights the recent Web 2.0 conference in San Francisco. In the next half hour, Yahoo Chairman and CEO Terry Semel on the intersection of technology and media companies, AOL Chairman and CEO Jonathan Miller on moving AOL away from the walled garden model, Sun President and COO Jonathan Schwartz and Mozilla Foundation President Mitchell Baker talk to Tim O'Reilly about open source and distributing software and services, former FCC Chairman Michael Powell explores the future of entertainment. We hear from the gaming industry on what it's like to be the little guy, and Jason Fried, CEO of 37 Signals, talks about the advantages of having less. This week, we take on the challenge of trying to distill day 2 of the recent Web 2.0 conference into a half hour of audio excerpts. Entertainment was a consistent thread throughout this second day, starting with a conversation that John Battelle conducted with Yahoo Chairman and CEO Terry Semel. Before joining Yahoo 4 years ago, Semel spent most of his life working in Hollywood. Now, he thinks, he has it all. Distribution, content, and technology.
I think if you look at the 20th century, the world that I came from in media, it was all about two things. It was about your content, and it was about your distribution. So it had no bearing on technology. Technology happened in some other place, and every 10 or 15 years, it was a new piece of technology, call it DVD or something else, and the studios were able to just enhance that and take advantage of that technology. Yahoo and the Internet in the 21st century, big difference, hand in hand. You can't have one without the other, in my opinion. So to be a media company, technology is in the core of it. Technology is what you must excel at. It's what's going to help create the opportunities and the situations and tied together. So it goes to all three. It goes to technology, it goes to content, and it goes to distribution. Yahoo has always had distribution, approximately 400 million users throughout the world. Content is what Yahoo's all about, has always been all about. And engineering and technology, the ability to bring it to our folks and the ability to bring it to the world. So I see us as a 21st century technology company that drives great media.
The mainstream media, which seem a little scared of Yahoo in particular moving into their space. You recently hired a high-profile journalist, for example, and sending him around to all the war-torn areas of the world. That feels an awful lot like what CNN's supposed to be doing, right? Or the LA Times is supposed to be doing. How do you respond to their concerns, or do you care?
I do care because I think that, in general, I see Yahoo, which is, again, all about content. So anywhere you go on Yahoo, whether it's autos or it's finance or it's sports, it's all content. And I see not two but three ways of us generating content as we go forward and participating at times. One would be totally user-generated content. Mm-hmm. Everything in and around community, everything in and around what we call 360, providing the templates, providing the tools, and in some cases providing the themes, as you'll see going forward, to enable people, whether they're using Flickr or 360 or local, to participate in user-generated content. Great area for the Internet, great area for Yahoo. On the other hand, what Yahoo has always been doing, it'll continue to do, which is to license, to aggregate, and to work with partners, and have other people look to us as a distribution platform with an enormous audience. Thirdly, and in no uncertain order, to also help design the future of what content may be on the Internet, in addition to user-generated and things that others are doing, to start to lay the groundwork for what things might look like in this broadband world that's connected to all devices and ultimately part of IPTV. I don't want to wait 10 years while others experiment at what is the way. I think Yahoo should take a leadership position and start to move on some of it.
Yahoo Chairman and CEO Terry Semel on the future of content on the Internet, here on Distributing the Future. Yahoo isn't the only company looking at how their business model needs to change in the future. AOL has been working on changing from a walled garden to a modern internet company that can reach at least 10 times as many customers. Program Chair John Battelle talked with AOL Chairman and CEO Jonathan Miller about the changes at AOL.
The number one goal that I gave the company internally is get in sync with the market. And it's just that simple to me, that a proprietary walled garden approaches, to my mind, are not in sync with the market, not in sync with where the world's going. And, you know, you have to change your thinking and think differently. And it's hard when your economics and your history tells you to be something else. But I think that, you know, we've passed that point.
So, but you're not abandoning the ISP business.
No, but I don't think ISP means walled garden.
No, I'm just...
The press likes to say, because you're losing subscribers, you're doing this web thing. And I say, no, it's not true. Because if you look at it, if you look at the world and say, okay, how many subscribers do you want me to have? So give me a number, you know, 30 million in the United States, 35, fine. So Yahoo, Microsoft, how many users do they have worldwide? And the answer is, depending on what you believe, but it's 350 million, 400 million. It's going to be 500 million. And so I say, do you want your entire business to be defined by that set of subscribers? Or do you, in fact, want to take the words World Wide Web literally and think about the World Wide Web and, in fact, embrace, because you do have one of the, I'll come back to brands in a second, but we have the ability to embrace the World Wide Web on a worldwide basis. And it seems to me, it doesn't mean you don't want a subscriber business. It's not either or, but you have to have a worldwide view. Think about the brands on the web. And let's define great big brands on the web as 100 million plus users, things like that, just for the argument. And I would make the argument that there's only been one of those created in the last 10 years. And that brand is Google. That if you look at Yahoo, which is one of them, and Microsoft and AOL, those are all more than 10 years old, as are Amazon, eBay. So I don't know why exactly that is, but it just says that it's hard to create one of those really big at-scale brands on the web. With all the innovation, with all the capital that goes in and all the great ideas, it still must be hard to do because it isn't done that often. And therefore, if you have one of them, which AOL is, and I would actually argue we might have two in our company, the other one being AIM, that the worst thing you can do is limit that down to in essence, mean dial-up subscriber, you know, brand. That's the worst thing you can do with one of these great brands, and you can't ever create one of them. You can't ever think you're just going to create one, because, you know, out of thin air. Those are unbelievably hard to do and hard to come by. So it seemed to me, as I guess brand steward, that the most important thing would be as expansive as possible with that. So all these roads lead me to the same place.
Jonathan Miller on protecting two brands, AOL and AIM. Easier to protect what you have than to create a new one. Our brand is O'Reilly Media. And we're distributing the future. AOL isn't the only company having to reassess their business model going forward. Sun has traditionally sold servers. Now they're looking at renting you CPU time on demand. You need a bunch of computers to crank on your research and you have a grant to cover it? They're there for you. Did a hurricane just blow through and you need to perform a quick simulation? Well, you can rent dozens of processors on the grid. Sun President and COO Jonathan Schwartz and Mozilla Foundation President Mitchell Baker joined Tim O'Reilly. Schwartz doesn't think that open source is about the code.
One of the ways you have to think about open source is the distribution of intellectual property. And I think that can't be underestimated, but there are a minority of users in the world that know what on earth to do with the Mozilla source tree. Free software is what has massive power. Google is powerful, not because they're running on any one technology, but because their service is free. If you choose to focus on the code, you miss the massive phenomena that's taken over the world, which is the freedom with which you can access wonderful network services. Source code has no value in and of itself. We have to combine both the distribution of code with the delivery of services that people are going to want. And the price tag, you know, has a lot to do with it. You can reach a lot more people in the world with a free product than one that if you charge.
Right, but at the end of the day, Sun sells hardware, and Google...
No, that's not true. What we just announced yesterday had nothing to do with hardware, did it?
I understand, but it's a huge part of your business. And so you've got to figure out what that transition is from one business model to another.
You're presupposing that people bought the hardware for the hardware and not for what I claim they bought it for, which is they love Solaris.
Right, but when there was a time in the 90s when you could legitimately make the claim that Sun was the power behind the internet. And I think you can't make that claim anymore. I mean, Linux has really taken over.
You mean Red Hat?
No, I don't mean Red Hat.
I don't think
Google runs Red Hat.
I'm sorry, Google builds their own computers.
That's right.
I don't see a lot of customers doing that.
I think that you may be, you know, bucking a trend there. But we can agree to disagree, because the fact is...
How many of you build your own computers?
Yeah, how many use the services that run on computers that are built that way? That's the question, not how many people build their own. But let's not go there. I mean,
we should, Tim. I mean, this is the...
we might fight over that one. I mean, it seems to me that you do have a strategy that you've expressed in the past, which is buck a CPU hour,
yeah.
Which is a consequence of thinking about delivering what you do as a service. How's that going?
There is a distribution of people who bond to the idea that paying for computing services actually makes sense for them. And so if I could, the spectrum goes from you're a big bank that does Monte Carlo simulations on your portfolio. You need tens of thousands of CPUs to go run these simulations. So having engaged with those folks, what you end up with is a 500-page contract that describes how you're going to build an air-gap network that is specific with their, you know, InfiniBand switches, and you just go down a rat hole. So our mistake was assuming that that was the belly of the market. Now, more interestingly, when we open this up to be a retail service, stay tuned, that's just around the corner. And by retail, I mean you're going to be able to go to a website, log in, take your PayPal ID, and boom, go buy CPU hours.
Customer self-service, one
customer
of the key
self-service.
Principles it's, of Web 2.0.
And, which is a good thing. Sadly, the government would like to interject itself and claim if you're using more than one CPU, you're building a weapon.
Are you serious?
I am dead serious. but all that aside, we had an interesting rush of demand, I think it was last week or the week before, from oil and gas companies in Texas. Why were they so eager? It's called Hurricane Rita.
All right.
And all of a sudden, there was no 500-page contract. There was just a, how do we get our work into that grid so we can get it done? And boom, we sold out the initial infrastructure.
Nice.
And so what I see happening is a couple things. One, the customers who are really getting over the cultural hurdle to self-service are going to get there quickly. But the majority of the market is going to be from a guy at Princeton University who's a protonomic modeler who just wants to get access to a ton of CPUs quickly, and he's got $5,000 in his budget, and he's going to spend it. That, to me, the long tail is going to be the majority of the revenue in the market, not figuring out a way to convince a investment bank that we want to customize a grid for them. That's called customization. That is not, to me, the future of the internet.
Yeah, I believe in principle that you're right. I'll be really interested to figure out if the market does play out that way. I hope it does, because I think that is, in fact, a viable future. I guess the question from an economic point of view, though, is, how does the revenue from that stack up to your current revenue sources? And does it support the same cost structures? Does it support the same kind of company? Or does it support a different kind of company?
I think the economic opportunities are much, much more attractive in the next generation of the business than we've seen to date. And so my belief is, just from the modeling we've been doing, the monetization opportunities around the grid, and by the way, we're not going to be the only ones who are going to deliver a grid. We're going to go sit down with the big telcos and have them deliver grid services as well, will surpass the margin and profit opportunities of figuring out a way to hock a box and, try to make 30 points of margin on it.
Right.
There's another aspect to that, too, which is the actual cost of doing things. Right now, we take for granted the cost of control structure is very high, whether it's the 500-page contract and the whole infrastructure that's built up around having something centralized and needing to control it. It's the same with open source and I think with Web 2.0. And one of the things that I don't think we've really explored yet are what are the actual savings with self-service in an infrastructure level. So I think looking back in 5 or 10 or 20 years, it may well be that we look at the model we take for granted 5 years ago of proprietary software, each copy is licensed, we make a whole new law so that shrink wrap licenses are enforceable, we worry about piracy, we have this giant infrastructure that's all based on a center trying to control. And I think that as that begins to change to customer self-service, people being able to actually do more things, that the cost of enforcing control will become, we'll see how prohibitive and what a drain it is in the current system. So I think there's some expense savings that we haven't begun to understand yet.
The Mozilla Foundation's Mitchell Baker, computing becomes less expensive with self-service and the removal of the enforcement of control. She joined Sun's Jonathan Schwartz and Tim O'Reilly in a panel at this year's Web 2.0, Distributing the Future. My mother-in-law watches interviews with celebrities and assures me that so-and-so is a really nice man. Of course, the celebrity knows the camera's on and is careful to shape the image that you have of them. Nevertheless, she's certain that she's gotten to know their real personality. So, I'm a bit embarrassed to say that I had a similar experience at Web 2.0. For years, I've had this opinion of Michael Powell based on the stories we read about his tenure on the FCC as chairman. But after the Web 2.0 panel on the future of entertainment, I found myself thinking, wow, he's really a nice man. He's got a breadth and a depth of experience, and he seems to be on the right side of most of the important issues. Yeah, I know. It's the same thing I tease my mother-in-law for doing. Well, here's some excerpts featuring Powell from that panel discussion. He begins by responding, why we don't have an infrastructure that can rival Korea's.
You know, it is a really important point that you really have to build your deployment incentives and policy around your geography and your demographic. And I mean, I think the U.S. is a very different technological problem and challenge than the South Korea market is. That's not to say it's an excuse, but it means you need an even bolder, farther-reaching, I think, broadband policy in order to make that happen. You know, my distress, if there is one in this space, is that I don't think I hear very many public policy leaders, political leaders, who understand what are the elements and hallmarks of creating an economy that has innovation and networks effects as one of its greatest drivers. I think we still look at broadband policy and infrastructure policy as utilities regulation. I think the average congressman thinks this is like oil, gas, water, natural gas, and broadband. But yet, if the information age is the third great economic epic of world history, it's a hell of a lot more than that. You know, it's socioeconomic opportunity for American citizens, it's healthcare, it's the education system, it's immigration policy. I mean, an enlightened innovation policy ripples through all of that, for one, and I think we haven't gotten there yet. Expectations do keep changing, but so do other things that a consumer puts value on. Look at cell phones, for example. I mean, the Ma Bell Network's premium hallmark was that 99.69's reliability and quality. An enormous amount of consumers are more than happy to accept a somewhat degradation in voice quality in exchange for mobility and drop calls. And a number of people are willing to accept the flexibility afforded by voice over IP in exchange for that additional functionality. I have a child who, if I say to my 16-year-old, why don't you use iTunes and pay 99 cents for music, he goes, Dad, that sucks. Music should be free.
Does he know who you are?
Yeah. Right. I just hope the Washington Post didn't know who he is.
Well, they do now.
But you know what's funny is that same child has a $40 ringtone bill. Now, last time I checked, a $2.99 ringtone is a really bad sampling of a song. But he's become very acclimated that that's rational to him. And a $60 Halo 2 cartridge is equally rational to him. So I think that consumer expectations and acclimation is an important part of the development of these industries. And to the extent that you acclimate consumer to different perceptual expectations, you can create markets where it didn't seem there would be. Yeah, I think hiring lawyers and suing is a hell of a lot easier to the average corporation than figuring out how to be creative. And, you know, at the end of the day, shame on them. You know, when I was a kid and vinyl records went away and CDs came, everybody said, oh, don't worry, they're going to cost the same thing as records eventually. You know, and that was about $7.99.
Oh, and by the way, they last forever.
Yeah, they're going to last forever.
Why do you need a backup copy? Thank you, Jack Valenti.
Last time I walked in Best Buy, they're still $15.99, and you're asking, you know, 16, 18-year-olds to blow huge amounts of disposable income to buy a record that has one decent Britney Spears song, if there is one. You know, and take the rest. And I think that one of the things I think the industries are missing is the power of the new tools and toys is that consumers expect to be attended to or they have the tools to create their own situation and enter Sean Fanning and a better solution. And I think that they're classic in doing this in an effort to buy time because they're not as good at being creative and innovative to serve the needs of their customers.
Michael Powell on the future of entertainment. Last week I was talking to Make Magazine Associate Editor Phil Terone about this phenomenon that Powell referred to, where teens won't pay 99 cents for music because music should be free, but they will spend 3 to 4 times that amount for a short sample of that same tune to use as a ringtone. Phil explained, that's because ringtones aren't music. A ringtone is an accessory. We're distributing the future. Innovation on the internet has traditionally been driven by gaming and, well, pornography. There were no sessions on pornography on day 2 of Web 2.0. There was, however, a panel on gaming. Here they discuss whether it's hard for the little guy to make it in a world of really big, rich, powerful players.
If you really believe that it's game over the minute you have to compete against big guys, I would argue that most of Silicon Valley would have been wiped out years ago. We all believe in the Valley that you can take on anybody. And in fact, if you're small enough, you know, a Microsoft or a Cisco or now for us, or an Intel, but now for us an EA, is just one more large company that we have to be faster than, moving quicker than, recruit better people than, and that's what we're doing, and I think we're doing it quite ably. As a matter of fact, the fact that Time Warner invested in us, I thought, was not only an endorsement of the space, but in some senses a recognition that they did not have within their halls the sort of talent and ability to move as quickly in an entrepreneurial space as they need to. And I think that story gets repeated in this space. It has been repeated elsewhere. Small companies create technology, create momentum that can't be replicated by a slower-moving company, and eventually they either lose out totally or they acquire that company, and in either case, the smaller company, if they create value, succeeds.
It's much better to compete against large companies because of the speed issue. Skype had put out 42 basically updates of their product in the 2 years between they launched and when they were acquired. Xfire has put out 43 updates. We do an update every 2 weeks. If you look at it, an instant messenger or an operating system update of some of the major players out there, it's 18-month time frame or multi-year time frame. So it's much more fun to compete against something when you have 42 upgrades and they have one. But I also don't think it's really necessarily competition against the big ones. Like Greg is saying, it's partnerships. The big media companies are dying to get into gaming, and they would love to work with the people who have sort of successful, rapidly growing businesses. And also, I think it's great for the industry as a whole, because that money that comes in from the attention focused by the big media companies will make it a much more exciting industry for everyone and much more revenue-generating opportunities for everyone. I mean, look what happened to the quality of television programming a long time ago when suddenly advertising dollars came in and the quality of programming could go way up. So I think it's exciting and exhilarating, not game over by any stretch of the imagination.
Almost makes you feel bad for the big guys. Has the model changed? How big should your company be? Now, hold that thought a minute. You might change your mind after this next piece. Suppose you want to start a company. What do you think you need to get started? Well, Jason Fried, CEO of 37 Signals, says you'll do a lot better with less. You don't want or need as much money as you think you do. Think you need more than 3 people? Well, maybe you're trying to attack too hard a problem. In fact, maybe you're spending too much time working on your project. Take 10 hours a week off. I know, all this sounds nuts. Until you hear him explain the math behind why less is more.
Traditionally, people think of less as a bad thing, and they think they need to do more. So they have a competitor, and they need to outdo the competitor. The competitor has 5 features, they need to have 6. If the competitor is spending $30 million, they need to spend $50 million. They need to keep outdoing people. It's a very Cold War mentality way of doing things, trying to one-up everybody. So what I would suggest is that people start thinking about one-downing people. Not outdoing, but underdoing people. So what I want to talk about are 5 specific things you actually need less of that you probably think you need more of, but I think you need less of. And the first one is this idea of less money. Usually an entrepreneur comes up with an idea and they write a business plan, which I don't recommend anybody does, by the way. But they go write a business plan and then they go out and try and get some funding so they can do something with this business plan. And I think if you're building maybe a factory or a warehouse or something, you're going to need some cash. But if you're building a web-based application, you just don't simply need money anymore. All money's going to do, all other people's money is going to do is going to put you in debt. And debt is the worst place to start anything, especially when you're trying to build products. It doesn't make you build better products. It doesn't make your customers happy. It's not going to make you happy. It's not going to make your decisions any better. So I would suggest that you don't go out and get money. Because what money used to get you was hardware, which is virtually free nowadays. It used to buy you software, which is essentially free these days. And if you need some services to run your business, you can find them online very cheaply. It could never buy you time, and it could never buy you passion. And a boatload of passion is really what you need to build great products these days. So all money really buys you these days are salaries, and salaries buy you people. And I would suggest actually that you need less people. In fact, you only need 3 people to get started building anything these days online. And if you think your product needs more than 3 people, I would suggest that your product's probably too complex. And instead of scaling your headcount up to match your vision or your feature set ideas, you might want to scale your feature set and your vision down to match your headcount. You're probably doing way more than you need to do. And we've all used software that does way more than it needs to do, and none of us like using that kind of software, yet we all still try and build it. So I would suggest less people, and all you really need is 1 designer, 1 programmer, and 1 kind of sweeper, which is what we call people who kind of move back and forth between the two worlds, and also has a bit of business knowledge and some kind of good common sense when it comes to how to market your product. When you have less people, you're naturally going to be able to do less, and you're naturally going to have less time. And less time is a huge advantage, actually. It sounds like a bad thing, but it's actually a good thing. If you have 10 people working 40 hours a week, you have 400 hours to pour into your product. If you have 3 people, you may have 120 hours if everyone's working 40-hour weeks. Sounds like you're at a disadvantage, but you're not. You're actually at a huge advantage because most of the time you spend is actually wasted time. It's non-productive time. It's time in meetings. It's time thinking too much. It's time overanalyzing. It's time building more than you need to build. So if you have less time, you're naturally going to care more about that time. That time is more valuable to you, and you're going to use it on better things. I would suggest you work less. Instead of putting 40 hours a week into your product per person, put 30 hours a week into the product per person. And I think that you'll find that you're being forced into building better products, and you're being more creative with your time. So from less time, you know, you have to wonder, okay, if I have less time to spend on my product, you know, how do I manage that time? What do I need to cut out so I don't have to worry about all this time I've lost? And I would suggest that you kind of think about less abstractions. And what I mean by that is you do less stuff that's not real. We have this big idea that we call getting real, which is only building things. It's not thinking about them too much. It's not writing about them too much. It's not drawing them down, making boxes and arrows and charts and diagrams. It's actually building the things and seeing what happens and learning as you go. A very, very iterative approach. Don't write functional specifications. Instead, build the product and start from the interface first. Build the UI first. Build the customer experience first. And then wrap that with the technology. Have the technology fill in the back end instead of starting from the tech and then painting an interface on it first. You want to spend your time working on the customer experience first. That's what defines your product, not the tech you're using, not the Ajax stuff, not the RSS stuff, not all the stuff. It's really the customer experience. So start there. Have the interface screens be the functional specification, because there's certainly something functional about an interface you can click through and use and look at. There's nothing functional about a functional specifications document. And they generally lead to what we like to call illusions of agreement. Everybody reads this document, and everyone says they agree eventually, and then you start building it, and no one agrees anymore. And 6 months down the road, when you've finally delivered your product, it looks nothing like the original spec. Yet you spent 3 months focusing on the spec and getting the spec right, and you're just wasting your time. So build, learn as you go, make mistakes as you go, correct mistakes as you go. You're going to know a lot more about what you're doing as you're doing it than before you're doing it. All these things about less people, less money, less time, less abstractions lead to the kind of the key point here, which is this idea of less software. Building less software, software that does a lot less, less features, less support that's required, less documentation that's required, less help sections that are required, less confusion, less having to sell to people because they don't understand everything you're trying to provide, less stuff, less things to explain, less things for people to have to understand and comprehend. So less software, I think, is really the key to building great tools these days, very specific tools. There are a million simple problems to solve before anyone should even spend any time trying to solve the complicated ones. Or let your competitors solve the complicated ones, because they're most likely going to fail, as very, very few people have solved very, very complex problems with software. with the exception of probably like air traffic controllers and whatnot. But like when we're talking about web-based software, you don't need to go solve the complex problems. There's plenty of simple problems you can cherry-pick and nail and make an awful lot of people happy by solving the simple problems that they deal with every day. Everything you do needs to matter, and it needs to be real, and it just isn't about having this unlimited these unlimited resources and all the options in the world. It's about having a lot less, and you're going to be much, much, much better products. You're going to be happier, you're going to be more satisfied, and your customers are most definitely going to be much happier with simple solutions to their problems.
Jason Fried from 37 Signals on Why Less is More. We featured the second day of this year's Web 2.0 conference in this edition of Distributing the Future. You'll find more information in our show notes at O'ReillyNet.com/future. Thanks to Terry Semel, Jonathan Miller, Jonathan Schwartz, Mitchell Baker, Tim O'Reilly, John Battelle, Michael Powell, and Jason Fried. We're beta-testing this new show in public so that we can benefit from your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme music. Visit David's website at www.batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro.